This episode of the MGMA podcast is brought to you by Walmart Business. It's the Walmart you love, now for business. Get everything you need for your staff and patients in one place. Enjoy big savings on health and safety products, cleaning supplies, over-the-counter medications, and much more. And don't forget the break room snacks. Create a free account today and start shopping at business.walmart.com. That's business.walmart.com. Well, hi, everyone. This is Daniel Williams, senior editor of MGMA and host of the MGMA Podcast Network. We are back with another MGMA Insights podcast today, and we have a guest that I am really excited about. It's Dr. Dawn Tartaglione, who serves as the Medical Director of Neurosurgery at Bay Health in Dover, Delaware. And our doctor here goes by Dr. T, so that's how I'm going to refer to you the rest of the show. Dr. T, welcome to the MGMA podcast.
Thank you, Daniel. It's an honor to be here today. I'm really looking forward to this, and I answer to Dr. T in all environments, and I also answer to pretty much anything due to my difficult pronunciation of the last name. So thank you again.
Yeah, you and I met about a month or so ago, and I'd like to think we really hit it off. That was really fun getting to connect with you and talk with you, learn more about your story. And I told you then, and I'll tell you again now, I have never met a neurosurgeon before, and this is such a cool opportunity here. I want to know about that. So first of all, just tell us about that healthcare journey. When did you know you were going to move into neurosurgery? Because there are a lot of specialties out there in the medical field.
Well, thank you, Daniel. I was interested in medicine and biology from a young age. I was interested in science. I had a great sixth grade science teacher, Mrs. Cackley, and I really stayed interested in all science. I was interested in math and music as well. I played the piano and I played that in college as well. So I think a lot of people say there's a math, medicine, music relationship. So I think I had it, if it does exist. And by the time I got ready to graduate from high school, I was pretty sure I wanted to either be a biology professor or a doctor. I was blessed to go to university and graduate. And during that time, my teachers really led me to, you know, they have to build up your confidence too, to say, you know, do you think you can be a doctor? I had a lot of support and I enjoyed that a great deal. I went to undergrad at Truman State University in Kirksville, Missouri, and it was wonderful. Then once I went to medical school in Chicago, I really did enjoy the studying, actually, those first 2 years, but I could tell I was thinking about something maybe with, you know, the ability to do procedures on people. I like the idea of an event or a procedure or a completed task. So that was very interesting to me. And then my first third year medical student rotation was on trauma surgery. And I had thought I wanted to be a trauma surgeon because I thought, okay, you'll see it all and you'll try to put things back together. And about 6 days into trauma surgery, I was like, that's probably not going to be too fun. And I got the opportunity on that rotation to scrub a lot of neurosurgery cases. And I was like, this is for me. Yeah, then I just got lucky enough. I mean, I did study, but I mean, I got lucky enough that I got a residency, and I guess the rest is history. I mean, it was just everything fell into place.
Right. Let's talk about that a little bit more then, just for us who are on the outside of it. What is it like being a neurosurgeon? I mean, that's serious stuff. I mean, you are operating on, you know, people's brains. I'm taking. Tell us a little bit about that. So what is that like to perform that type of surgery?
Well, in neurosurgery, one thing that you have to remember is when you work on the nervous system, you don't have a backup. There's no second organ. There's no other kidney, for instance.
Right.
You know, so there are unpaired organs of the body that there is a certain amount of inherent risk when you operate that organ. Its functioning is extremely important, and you need to mitigate any risk that you put these organs through every chance you can. So about neurosurgery, obviously we are taught to do neurosurgery in a very stern and rigid environment for a reason. And that is that you need to learn how to do it properly. So the most important thing and the people you could never repay enough, of course, are your teachers, the people that taught you how to operate. And then the people that taught you who to operate, and most importantly, who not to operate. So I think that whole picture of teaching is important. And what it's like to be a neurosurgeon is you get to be working on a wide, it's kind of a wide number line. You know, there's 0 to 10, let's say, on a number line. People that the fun part of your job is meeting people that is not fun for them, I guess, because let's say a person with a herniated disc. You meet a person with a problem that you can offer them an operation when the time is right for them and in the course of their illness, and you can do a disc surgery that you've done many thousands or hundreds or thousands of times before, and you can really help that person. They can get back to their life. That's still a serious operation because I always tell the patient it's important because you're having it and I'm doing it. But in the scheme of things, you know, this is something that we can demonstrate a fairly reproducible model of success. And then there are people that are 9s and 10s on the number line, people who have brain tumors in locations in which these tumors are not going to be resectable or close to completely resectable, or they're going to be completely inoperable. And then you just feel terrible. You feel terrible you can't take it all. You feel terrible that it's in that location. And you just try to keep your spirits up and try not to, you know, give people no hope, but you try not to give them false hope. Some of that part of the job, to me, that's the 10 out of 10 of the hard part.
Right. Give us an idea of that then, because we talk a lot about, you know, the bedside manner of a physician. But when you're having those kind of conversations, both with the patient and with their loved ones, walk us through what a conversation like that might look like.
Well, amongst doctors, sometimes we'll say, what's going on with this patient? And they'll say, oh, the critical situation. And in my mind, I click to what we used to say in residency. Oh, I got to go up to such and such room. You know, it's time for a death speech. Every one of those is slightly different. Or it's time to come to the ER and break it. You know, they haven't break it to the family. They haven't, the patient has not had the response we'd hoped to the resuscitation or the response that we'd hoped. And sometimes you have to have that conversation after surgery that you know that the patient's life is going to be very short, sometimes minutes to hours, sometimes days to weeks. And sometimes, you know, you just have to tell it. I try to make a rapport with the family if I can. And anytime I've operated a person, hopefully I've had the opportunity to meet a few of their family before the event, or at least talk to them on the telephone. That does help the rapport after somewhat. And then I try to do it in person as, you know, anytime that's possible. And generally I try to identify with the people. I mean, you know, you go in the room, you're going to have to take in someone's culture, appearance, condition, language. You know, you got to get into the situation and get everything onto the family's page as much as you can. If you need the interpreter, you get that in the hall before you go in, get it on the phone, get it ready. If you can tell that, you know, there's 30 people that you're going to be telling the story to, you always stay between them and the door in case you need to exit. There's just all kinds of things you want to take into consideration like that. I generally start the conversation with, you know, some of the things that we were concerned could happen have happened. So I try to start it with a definitive sentence, mm-hmm. and then I try to soften it somewhat. I apologize once, usually, for being blunt, and usually they will go ahead and interrupt you and thank you for being blunt, and then I just tend to tell it.
Yeah. There's you, there's the patient and their family, but there's also your team, and you're the medical director of neurosurgery at Bay Health. So what's the communication you as that medical director have with your team in these serious situations or in just in general to build both the morale, inspire the team, and lead the team?
Well, our team is another neurosurgeon and soon to be a third. And we have 5 what we call advanced practice clinicians. We have a CNS, 3 nurse practitioners, and a PA. And we are so blessed that our experience level among our team, as far as neurosurgical nursing or advanced clinical practice, they have over 100 years of experience combined. So these are people that have heard many of the difficult situations throughout their training and on their journey to where they are on our team now. And there are people on our team that can probably do the speech better than me. Mm-hmm. They are really skilled. It is difficult to try to do anything other than commiserate a little bit and then try to find the good side of it when we are all sitting together after we've had to break something to somebody or an event has happened that was terrible. And, you know, you have to just talk it out or sit together and try to find something good in it. It is difficult, but we are blessed with a mature team of really smart people. And I do feel like that since there are five of them that, you know, whenever possible, they also relieve each other. They can read each other really well. So it's a terrific blessing.
You and I did talk about a month or so ago, and I asked you this question then, but tell us about Bay Health. Let's just step back a little bit and get a better understanding about what Bay Health is about and your role there as the medical director of neurosurgery.
Well, Bay Health is a hospital system. It has a main hospital in Dover, and it has another hospital in Milford. So they're about 30 minutes driving apart. The hospital in Milford is new in 2019, and it is really beautiful and fabulous. And then the hospital in Kent, it is the original old hospital, built on many times, soon to be an additional awesome new towers. It's amazing. But what's really cool in the building, I don't mind it having old sections and new, because when you're there inside the building, as you walk down what we call the spineway, and each of the older, spokes sticks off to the side, they've enclosed like the original bricks from the original building inside. And I think it's cool.
That's so cool.
And I always say a hospital is a hospital. It doesn't all need to be brand new for me. But Bay Health has been here since the 1920s. And it is a system that has dedicated itself to serving Delaware and those on the Delmarva Peninsula. And they've really done a terrific job. There's only a couple other small hospitals out here on what we call the Delmarva Peninsula. And they've really built these programs up here to where they have open heart program. We have neurosurgery with the neurosurgical ICU, and there's only specific types of diagnoses that require care to be transferred to a tertiary center. That being said, we also have many medical directors of our different departments that have relationships with these tertiary care centers. So the open dialogue and the ability to help a patient without them having to be transferred it's amazing too. It's a much better relationship than I've seen at other hospitals, you know, with their surrounding hospitals.
Yeah.
And Bay Health has a really good set of values, and they are similar to mine. Specifically, integrity and respect are things that I think a lot of people really tend to work on. And they've really recently, we've got some new leaders, our new CNO, and some people that integrity is really important to. And I think the future looks very good for Bay Health.
Yeah. Tell us about your typical day then. I mean, you're the medical director there. You're over a team.
Yeah.
What's going on for you?
I'll tell you about I'll run you through a couple days in a row because one day only affects the next, right? Well, for instance, Friday night, we were up all night because a sick lady came to one of our outside ERs up in Smyrna. So we worked to get her transferred and they did a great job. By the time she got to our hospital at Kent, she had declined rapidly. So now she needs imaging pretty much all night long, you know, meaning get her ready, get her safe, get her airway protected, get her imaging done. Then we, you know, see how she does. And then we start thinking, okay, the problem she has is going to need a surgery. Then we start looking at, do I wreck Monday's operating room schedule? Do I wreck my own office schedule on Tuesday? What's the best thing for the patient? Because that's what really matters. So on the weekend, we had some consults and calls, and we got some surgeries organized for this week. But that's generally what we do on the weekends is we look ahead to the week as things come in. And what's the best thing to shift? What's the best thing to make it fit? And again, the patient's always first. If the patient needs to go, they go to the operating room. So, for instance, tomorrow is normally Tuesday. It's my office day. That's my biggest office day. And tomorrow I do not have office. I'm going to be doing two cases instead. So my team this morning in the operating or in the office, the clinic ladies have already moved my office to Thursday. So I sent an email last night. They had done that by 9:30 this morning. Any patients that maybe they don't get a hold of that show up tomorrow, one of my advanced practice clinicians will just see them. They'll see them for free if they want to see the doctor on Thursday. If they can't see me Thursday, I can come in Friday morning or put them on for next Tuesday. So again, we've got flexible clinic staff that just can handle it and can handle patients being moved around. And then we've got the advanced practice clinicians in the hospital that can help me. You know, I'm trying to get a consent form from people in Florida. You know, it's amazing, but it comes together. We email and call to our surgery desk and everything is set tomorrow to operate on a day that's not even our regular day.
Yeah. You're talking about flexibility, and that's a challenge in general.
It's a challenge because I don't think I'm even flexible. I want everything just so. You can see my whole life, it doesn't happen.
I've been telling people this all month, but April is National Stress Awareness Month. You clearly know. I know.
Okay.
Exactly. And we've all seen the studies, and you've probably seen it firsthand, of stress and burnout. And then when you throw in, and you also have to be really flexible at your job, and it's not just going to be, you know, laid out for you perfectly exactly the way, you know, Monday through Friday, there are going to be changes and challenges. What do you do to deal with stress? And then how do you relay that to the team as well?
Well, for myself, what I do to alleviate stress is I have to cut off my Instagram time, because I'll do that thing where I go home and I just get on Instagram, then I pretend like I'm out of time. That's ridiculous behavior. And apparently the whole world's doing it, but that doesn't make me feel better.
Right.
But generally with our team, we try to bust out people that can get out early, get them out early. You know, if I'm done with clinic at 2:15 and my notes are done, then if I have three advanced practice clinicians in clinic and one is handling the inbox and one is doing some patient calls, you know, they try to bust out somebody a little early. So we do try to let people have a little life, you know, and get out, especially when it's not their call day. The other thing is we have five people, so they take full weekends at a time. So even though the doctors are on every other weekend, they don't have to get so worn out and burned out. They can do they can get fried from driving their kids around to activities on the weekend instead. They can choose something else. Yeah. I have one APC that on Mondays I'm always like, well, how was the runaround? And he's like, it's never gonna end. But you know, that's what you get when you have kids that are getting bigger, you know.
That's true.
But we try to support each other. We try to keep it light. My partner, Dr. Sigler, he has a great sense of humor. He's a little drier than I am, but he's hilarious. So, I mean, it does take the edge off if you can laugh, because it isn't a joke to say you might as well laugh because you don't want to cry. Right. You know, you really, when you can, you should try to have fun, because there's going to be plenty of situations you can't.
Yeah. What do you do for yourself for any kind of work-life balance? Do you have anything, hobbies or passions other than Instagram outside of the office that you enjoy?
I'm so embarrassed I even said that, but yes, I do. First of all, I am so blessed. I have a swimming pool. So I do like to swim. I also like to sit out there. So I like to sit in the sun and read. And yes, I do like to read neurosurgery, but I also like to read murder and death a lot. And then I like to watch Forensic Files, but I try not to because I've seen them all. There's no point.
Right.
I also like baseball. So last summer I made it down to see the Nationals twice and to see Baltimore Orioles once. And this year I'm going to go to all the parks because I went to Philly multiple times for different reasons because it's close to us, of course, but I didn't get to a Phillies game last year, but I will get to one this year. But I like baseball. Football is my favorite. I'm a Chiefs fan. I have to say that right now. Okay. I've been a Chiefs fan my whole life. I deserve everything good.
So you're not on the bandwagon. You're a front runner. You actually have been a Chiefs fan during the dark days and stuff.
Infancy. I was born when they were in the Super Bowl the first time, and I'm pretty sure my grandparents that were babysitting me that night were irritated because I probably just walked around talking. Yeah. So yeah, no, everyone is welcome on the Chiefs bandwagon. Everyone.
Yeah.
Taylor Swift, Travis Kelce, bring it.
Are you a Swiftie as well then?
I am a Swiftie. I like all the young ladies. I like Ariana Grande, BB Rexha. I like them all.
Okay. Okay.
So I like pop music and I like classic rock music and what they call classic rock that's new, like 80s.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that was my heyday. I was just having a conversation about the 80s. I was talking to my wife about Tina Turner and she was saying, oh, she wasn't that big of a star. And I went, did you sleep through the 80s? And that was her second act. She was like, it was her and Madonna and, you know, Whitney Houston. And that was the 80s. I mean,
that was the 80s.
Yeah. So I then showed her the Wikipedia page where it said that Tina sold like 150 million records. So I said, no, she's pretty big. I don't know.
So Tina Turner is one of our idols here on our neurosurgery team in the operating room.
Okay.
She's one of our idols. Sometimes we listen to a whole case of Tina Turner.
That's incredible.
During one whole surgery. One of our nurses that also scrubs into cases, I was able to get one of the Tina Turner Barbie dolls for her for Christmas last year.
Right.
Thank God I got it before she died because we had a lot. I mean, that was a sad, sad time in the OR.
For sure. Yeah. That was, and that just to explain my love for Tina Turner, that was my very first concert. She opened, her comeback had not formally hit yet. And so she was opening for Lionel Richie. This was, I want to say 1983. It could have been 84. It was one of those 2 years. And at the last second, a friend of mine, somebody else couldn't go. And they said, hey, I grew up in Mississippi, but she was going to play in Memphis that night. And I went, sure, I'll go. And it's still to this day, my two best concerts I've ever attended were Tina Turner, my first concert, not because it was my first, because she's just a ball of energy. It was incredible. Yeah. And then Willie Nelson at like 80, he played 55 songs. And it was like, my feet hurt a little bit, but those two are just my Mount Rushmore of concerts I've attended in person. But yeah, Tina Turner is just amazing. So yeah, I wanted to share.
I would love to see Willie Nelson also.
He's still performing, you know, in his 90s now. So because we're all over the place here, I have to comment because we're on video. I'm dating myself again going into the 70s, but your wall reminds me of the Partridge Family. So what is going on with the wall behind you? What is that?
Okay. So the situation is we're just in a regular office. It's nice enough. Of course, we want a new one because that's how we are. We're surgeons. But the office is just across the street from the hospital. And of course, we want to be in the hospital. And in the future, we will be. But our office is fine, but the walls are never thick in an office. So exam room 5 is directly behind me. So they gave me the corner. So here I am back in the corner behind the tire kink. But the wall here is very thin. So what I did was I could hear everything that goes on in room 5. But I also was like, I'm sure everyone can hear my loud mouth in here. So I decided I would order some soundproof tiles on Amazon because, you know, I'm so fancy. So I order some, but I only want the ones that are $14, like for 10. Like I don't want to get more expensive. So these are the colors you could get. So then I just made it like a checkerboard.
It's beautiful. It's beautiful.
Thank you. I put them up there. Then they all fell down because I put them up the way they said to. And then my husband and one of my PAs put them all up. So they stayed up.
That's incredible. I love that. All right. Well, we've got time for a couple more questions and we're all over the place. And I love this talking to you because you and I, again, we met about a month or so ago and we talked just like that then. And I said, I wish I had just hit record the first time because we just connected and we're all over the place. So I do want to ask you a couple of neurosurgery questions here. So one of them, you've had a 2-decade career. What's evolved? What's trending? What's going on in neurosurgery that would be interesting to the MGMA audience?
Some of the things that are going on in neurosurgery include, I mean, the newest thing, of course, is integrating some visual apparatuses for using AI or for better visualization in general, even through advanced navigation and some new AI applications. And that's in its infancy, I do believe. However, I'd say in the last 20 years, the ability to correct spinal deformity has blossomed dramatically, and it has helped a lot of patients. And that is the improvement in pedicle screw fixation and improvement in the ability to maintain what we call sagittal balance. So you're not just lining a bones up, the spine with screws and rods, but you're putting them back the way patients are supposed to be in their spine, and so they can stand and walk properly. That is really terrific. Some of the implants that we use now, they're not all titanium. We have some newer metals, tantalum, and other things that bone can grow into. So that's pretty amazing. We also have good opportunities now to get bone from other humans, meaning passed away humans, bone banks to help augment in surgery to add bone in, because then the person that you're putting the bone in, their body can resorb that but lay down new bone and not have to take the bone off the person's hip, which can sometimes hurt them longer than the actual surgery. Healing hurts them. And then I would have to say the navigation in surgery, the ability to use the advances in radiology imaging, such as MRI and CT scan and different kinds of angiography or blood vessel tests, to be able to put those images on a disc or send them to a machine in surgery, in which you can correlate something you see on the MRI, you can touch with a probe on the person's scalp, and you can see exactly where that is. So that helps you plan a tiny incision if necessary, a tiny opening. It can also help you plan a big one when there's a bone problem and it's got to come off. That's advanced from a lot in the last 23 years. Some of that was available in my residency, but since I've been in practice, it's pretty amazing. And the biggest thing of all is that stroke care, meaning the aneurysm ruptures that cause strokes, the aneurysms being treated in the endovascular suites, and all of those people not having to have open brain surgery, that saved hundreds of thousands of lives.
Okay. One of the other things in researching you, I found that I just had to ask, I don't know anything about this, but explain the benefits of deep brain stimulation programs and how they've impacted patients with neurological conditions. What's going on with that?
So deep brain stimulation is the idea that you can put a lead, so a thin wire with some four leads at the bottom, that you can put them deep into the brain in the centers that have to do with our automatic motion, meaning when we think of something and we want to reach for it, it takes many parts of our brain to do that. But the parts of the brain that help us move smoothly at the correct speed that the rest of the brain is telling us to move, and with the smoothness or the with the detailed ability to do fine motor, those areas of the brain can be stimulated to prevent symptoms or cause symptoms. And the main thing we do is we put leads in a deep part of the brain for controlling and improving the symptoms of Parkinson's disease.
Okay.
So the way this works is the lead is placed in the brain, and then up on the top of the head where the lead comes out by the bone, it's, you know, snapped down with a little plastic cover for the hole. And then that is tunneled under the patient's scalp and skin down to their chest, and a battery is connected to that. And what that can do when that battery is activated and the leads are set, usually by a neurologist or a trained person to set it, it will affect the ability for the arms and legs to move better. And it's remarkable. So when I first started doing deep brain stimulation, they said it gave patients about 5 hours per day of on, meaning they were better. It gave them on average 5 hours per day. What I saw in practice doing deep brain stimulation is in surgery, you could stimulate the area, and people that had only written an X for their signature for 25 years wrote their name in perfect cursive during the procedure. It's amazing. Now, deep brain stimulation is being used for many things. For essential tremor, it's vital. People that just have the familial tremors and develop essential tremor, it can just change their life. I mean, people can lose 55 pounds from not being able to get a spoon to their mouth because it's shaking. So it's revolutionary. It's actually been approved in the United States since the early 90s. Now we're seeing it more for other applications. They're doing more studies for depression, possibly even obesity. And they're also doing some studies I was just reading on the weekend for patients to help them with addiction. Because some people, every single thing that you don't want to do too much of, they get addicted to. You know, if they get off nicotine, they're onto cocaine. If they get off cocaine, they're onto alcohol. So some of these people that their brains are wired this way, they are trying to figure out how can they help them.
Wow. I love that. That is just incredible. I'm so glad that you are involved with this. Before we leave then, besides the deep brain stimulation, what's one more thing maybe that you're really excited about, either in neurosurgery, in healthcare, wherever you want to take this? This is a blank slate for you.
Well, I'm really excited about neurosurgery in general all the time. And I do feel like one of my callings as I get older is to help younger surgeons, you know, adjust to their practice and do a good job. I recently had a friend of mine that's a chairman at an important program in the United States tell me that there is so much information now and so many things to teach residents that at the end of their 7-year residency, he tells them, I've made you proficient. You need to practice 5 years to get good. So again, I want to try to help young neurosurgeons get their practice in, get their time in, figure out what they are good at. And, you know, I want them to not worry so much about extraneous things that they don't need to worry about. So that's one reason I'm really excited to have my new young partner coming. I want to make her life as she enters neurosurgery a lot better than mine was, a lot better than my other partner's was. And I really think that that's the only way we're going to get through. I mean, there aren't enough neurosurgeons. So we got to work as long as we safely can. Somehow you got to talk us into keep working, right? And then we've got to make sure the young people do not leave the field.
All right. Well, Dr. T, I am so glad to have met you. I owe Laura for reaching out to me, who works with you, to suggest to have you on the show. It's been a joy. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Daniel. It's been a pleasure. Talk to you soon.
All right. Well, that is going to do it for this episode of the MGMA Insights podcast. We've been joined by Dr. T, Medical Director of Neurosurgery at Bay Health. Thanks to all of you for being podcast listeners. The popular buzzword we've been seeing everywhere is AI. But what we all want to know is how we can implement and use it to our advantage when it comes to improving margins, accelerating cash flow, and optimizing staff performance. There's a one-stop shop using cloud-based predictive analytics. MGMA Analytics is your AI-enabled tool that upscales technology you've already been paying for, so you can silo your disparate systems and make data-backed business decisions. Visit mgma.com/analytics and see how AI can revolutionize your finances and operations. Again, visit mgma.com/analytics today.